The National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, presents Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. For dramatists, the goal of combining art, ideas, and entertainment for popular audiences proves not only elusive, but frustrating. On that topic, here's Brenda Murphy, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of dramatic literature at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. Professor Murphy's comments focus initially on the playwright George Bernard Shaw and his influence on 20th century theater.
The accepted theory for the well-made play is that you have, in the beginning, exposition, then you have a situation, then you unravel the situation. Shaw was really working against this action-centered notion, and he said, well, why not have a rhetorical drama in which you have an exposition, a situation, and a discussion of that situation, really a problem and a discussion of
with
that
no necessary resolution. Is that what you mean?
Well, that's an interesting point, because Shaw doesn't usually give you a resolution of the discussion in his plays, and that's one of the problems in looking at his plays. Shaw also tends to write conventional comedies. In other words, he doesn't do what he says he's doing. But there have been dramatists, obviously, who've picked up on his notion of the drama of discussion. And this combination of a rhetorical structure with a dramatic structure has worked out pretty well in many of Shaw's plays and in a lot of others.
Are there American dramatists who have succeeded in combining content and form?
Yeah, there are several versions of this. One kind of American version of what Shaw was doing is can be seen in plays by Rachel Crothers, for example, an excellent playwright of the 20s and 30s who isn't very well known, and Robert Sherwood, Philip Barry, a number of the playwrights of the 20s, who are really writing those kinds of discussion plays and hiding their comic structures. Another version is what Sam Smiley calls didactic drama of the 30s, or presentational drama, the sort of drama that, rather than representing a situation, rather than giving you simply a theatrical world in which a problem is discussed, turns the focus of the play out from the stage to the audience and involves the audience in the play. Now, didactic drama, didactic, essentially means teaching, and the idea is to get the audience to come to the same conclusion that the playwright comes to. It was most popular during the 30s in America, an obvious time for it to be popular because there were so many social problems. And there were a number of workers' theaters during the 30s, and a number of really quite good dramatists writing what was called agitprop at the time, or agitation propaganda plays, which focused on the audience and tried to essentially to mobilize them as workers.
Brenda, I understand that some American dramatists actually invite the audience onto the stage. They try to get them to participate in the action. Now, that does not sound like the rule of thumb that you would normally experience if you went to the theater. Why is that not a successful form of drama?
Okay, it can be a successful form of drama. And I think in American experience, there are really two versions of that idea. That's what we call presentational or didactic drama, the sort of notion that the audience comes into the world of the theater, is drawn into the stage. One thing you can do is simply get the audience to think by addressing your words to the audience. Another is to actually demand action from the audience. Now, the first way, simply getting the audience to think, was the method usually used by the workers' theaters of the 30s. Waiting for Lefty, a good example of that, is a representation of a labor meeting. Now, what happens is on the stage you have, I think there are five labor leaders, and it's the representation of the taxi cab strike of 1934. The play was written in 1935, a very topical thing. Each of the labor leaders gives a speech, and the whole movement and rhythm of the play is to build up to a climax. Now, the idea is that the audience is also the audience at the labor meeting. In other words, the audience is the workers being addressed. And so at the end of the play, when the leaders demand a strike, that they don't stand there and say, we got a strike. They look at the audience and say, now what do we have to do? And the audience has to answer, strike. and it was a tremendous success. It was so successful, actually, that it was banned in Boston, naturally, and also banned in a number of other cities in 1935. And opening night, the audience came up on the stage. They were so excited, and, you know, ended up going out into the street yelling, you know, strike, strike, strike.
I can think of one example that may have a parallel here recently, and that would be Paddy Chayefsky's screenplay for Network, when the mad anchorman screams out his window, "We're mad as hell and we won't take this anymore," and people actually begin to do it on screen. And I recall seeing this in the theater. There were people in the theater who were getting pretty excited about it.
Well, that's a great example, except it shows the limitations of the medium of film as opposed to live theater, because in film you can't be as immediate as you can in theater.
Brenda, what about examples of the living theater, the open theater, so-called? I understand that there were some pretty outrageous things done by way of protesting the Vietnam War, for instance.
Yes, this is taking the whole notion of presentational drama a step further from the didactic drama of the 30s, where rather than just demanding speech from the audience, as somebody like Odets is with Waiting for Lefty. In the 60s, the idea was actually to attack the audience, to challenge the audience.
Physically to attack the audience?
Sometimes, yes.
Really?
The idea was to get the audience was part of the production, and participation was demanded by many of the presentational dramas. In the
what specifically 60s. Happened?
Well, there's a broad range there. Two examples of presentational drama in the 60s is the Living Theater of Julian Beck and Judy Molina, which is the best known and an excellent troupe, which actually was begun a lot early, but I guess America wasn't ready for it. So Living Theater spent a lot of time in Europe before they hit America in the 60s. But the Living Theater tended, well, the idea of the Living Theater was to get people together. It was a very 60s kind of a thing, I guess.
It was a political act. Is that right?
Yes, yes. The Open Theater was a theater that went a little further than the movement, went a little further than the Living Theater. And this was what Artaud called the theater of cruelty. I would say Open Theater is an example of the theater of cruelty, which simply attacks the bourgeoisie, if you want to put it that way, and tries to strip the veneer of civilization from the audience and demands that the audience see itself in its most primitive form.
Well, why would people go to see this stuff if they know beforehand that they're going to be attacked, and if they know beforehand that the actors and the playwright are essentially looking down their noses or saying, "Look, we're going to show you yourself in an unfavorable light"? Why would people go to that?
That's a good question. Usually this type of theater has a very small and devoted following.
And one without a high sense of self-regard, I would guess.
Well, no. One without a high sense of regard for the bourgeois things that are being attacked.
I see.
For example, the obvious target for most of the 60s theater of cruelty type movements was the Vietnam War. And so attacking war, attacking man's warlikeness was what these people were after. And the people in the audience wanted to see how evil that was. They believed it was evil.
And the playwrights and the actors went so far as to use decapitated chickens and hideous photographs.
Oh yeah, this was common. The idea was to get the audience to participate in those violent feelings, and so that you would have, you know, almost orgies of violence on the stage in order to get the audience to feel how it felt to kill the Vietnamese or whatever.
And to what end did all of this move? The Aristotle's formula for purging oneself of fear and
no.
arousing pity, what?
Precisely the opposite. The whole notion of Aristotelian drama or mimetic drama, or tragedy, I should say, is the purgation of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
The old Aristotelian theory is that you feel pity and fear for the hero, and the action reaches a climax at which pity and fear are purged. And so the audience leaves the theater feeling purged of those emotions. In didactic or presentational drama, what you try to do is raise the emotions to the peak that the audience is going to do something, change things, in the case of the 30s, to organize, to revolt, to form a labor union, to strike, in the case of the 60s, to get rid of that war.
Brenda, why is it that American playwrights and American actors, the artistic temperament, if you want to put it that way, why is it that the people who are involved from the standpoint of composing and presenting drama, why are they so stuck on the idea that if it's popular, there's something wrong with it?
I don't think that that is so true of the playwrights and the actors and the people in the theater. I think this is more a fiction of academically oriented theater criticism.
Uh-huh.
We like to talk about dramatic literature as opposed to theater. So the sin is more succeeding with the public as opposed to succeeding with academia. Now, this is a special problem in America, I suppose, because the American theater has always been commercial. And up until the 70s, we never, aside from the Federal Theater Project during the 30s, we didn't have any kind of national subsidies of the art, of the theater. And so a play had to succeed in the theater commercially in order to succeed. Now, this led people like Henry James, who were trying to write for the theater, to look at it as a very base kind of a thing. A rather vulgar occupation. And that attitude is really more outside the theater than it is inside the theater. And actually, most really good playwrights do succeed commercially without, you know, really trying. Shaw is a good example of that. Great success commercially. And nobody put any more ideas into his plays than George Bernard Shaw.
What's going on now on the American theater scene? Is it an exciting time? How would you characterize it?
Well, it's been a very exciting time in the last few years, partly because of the decentralization of the theater. Broadway, since the late 60s, has not simply been Broadway. It's been Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway. And then aside from that, also the great development of regional theater, partly aided by the National Endowment for the Arts, and a lot of local support, has really mushroomed in the last 10 years. Now, this may be endangered these days. Theater programs are kind of suffering from the cuts. But that has been extremely exciting, and especially in terms of production. Not particularly in terms of new plays, though. We haven't really had a dramatic resurgence in the sense of dramatic literature. We haven't had as much a resurgence as a lot of critics would like to see and would expect from the amount of activity in the theater itself. And that's a question that I don't suppose anybody can answer.
Who would you say is doing the best work in terms of writing plays these days in the 1980s?
Well, there are a number of very interesting playwrights that came out of the 70s. Arthur Copit, Sam Shepard, Megan Terry. We could name a number of playwrights, but there aren't any, you know, literary giants that we can speak of. There's a great deal of promise and energy in the theater these days, but you can't just draw out your Eugene O'Neill or your Edward Albee of the 70s or 80s at this point.
Brenda, you've mentioned that in your view, successful drama combines a serious element, an artistic element, and yet it's entertaining. What are the prospects for that kind of theater in America now?
Well, the prospects aren't much different now than they've been for a long time. The situation commercially in New York since the 20s has been that really nobody can afford to go to the drama aside from upper middle class people. The Nicholas Nickleby running on Broadway right now is $100 a ticket. So that the audience has been restricted in the commercial theater. Now, this was beginning to change during the 70s when you began to have all the regional theaters and the special projects, the subsidized theaters, so that there were some interesting new developments in playwriting. but it doesn't look so good now. Well, the old problem about theater in America has always been there's been a younger entertainment industry that reaches a broader mass. First it was film, then it was television, or then it was radio, then it was television. Mm-hmm. So that live theater, in a sense, has been since the films really started to develop about 1919, has been, again, a kind of aristocratic type entertainment.
Yeah.
And so, well, I shouldn't say that. I should say it's been a bourgeois entertainment.
People don't miss what they don't know they're missing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And again, during the 70s, there was a lot more interest in theater in the schools, a lot more education kind of about live theater. Kids were seeing productions even in grade school and participating in productions. And, well, we can just hope that will continue. And when people get in the habit of going to the theater, they'll demand it, which they haven't been lately.
Brenda Murphy is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of dramatic literature at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. At the center, Professor Murphy is working on a project entitled American Realism and Dramatic Form. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently convened a discussion of the connections between philosophy and public policy, including topics such as medical ethics, education, and academic ethics. Speaking to those issues are Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center, George Schur, a scholar at the center and a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont, and James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor of philosophy, the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
What are we to make, what are physicians or others who come to philosophers to make of the fact that philosophers disagree among themselves all the time, that in fact there's hardly a single positive philosophical opinion about which you can get all philosophers to agree, that what one philosopher asserts another denies? What are the implications of this fact for the importance of philosophers on public policy, and how should people approach philosophers then, if this is a endemic part mm-hmm. of the philosophical process?
I'm tempted to disagree with you just to prove your point, but I won't. George, did you want to comment on that?
First of all, what Steve says, I think, does bring out an important sense in which philosophers are not experts as other sorts of experts are experts. Calling in a philosopher is not like calling in a plumber. You call in a plumber, you get your pipes fixed. And there's a pretty good independent test for when you've got your pipes fixed. If there's no puddle underneath, then you got them fixed. When you call in a philosopher, it's not like that. It's quite clear. You'll get an answer. Depending on which philosopher you get, you'll get one answer or another. Certainly, whatever answer you get will be, if it's interesting at all, contested by other philosophers. So calling in a philosopher doesn't, there's a sense in which it doesn't settle the issue for the person or the agency who's called in the philosopher. More can always be said, and more generally is said. Now, but the other half of that is that I don't see that matters terribly much. What follows from the fact that an argument on one side is matched by an argument on the other side? Well, I guess what follows is that the person or the agency who acts has to evaluate the competing arguments and make up his or its own mind. That seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable conclusion to draw. Philosophers don't relieve people of the obligation to make hard decisions. What they do is perhaps guide their thinking and make possible more informed thinking in the hard decisions.
Something happens, though, George, doesn't it, to this, what we said earlier, to the division of labor, if one has to labor through all these articles and all these arguments. Is there any sense, or Jim, do you know, or Steve, or George, is there any sense in any of these places? After what you just said, it strikes me as, you know, if a medical center decides to hire a philosopher slash ethicist, they better be very careful about the one they pick. But why not get a bunch of them together, a consensus view? I understand that for example, in psychiatry, in the psychiatric profession, I've been told that, you know, whether they decide something is a mental illness or not, they get in Congress and vote. And this year, smoking is in and something else is out or whatever. Well, you see what I'm driving at?
You could do that in philosophy, but should you pay any attention to it? In fact, should you pay any attention to it in psychiatry either?
Mm-hmm.
And we could get a group of philosophers and vote. And if you wanted to take that as definitive, I think you'd be just as justified as taking the vote in any area as definitive. It's just that votes aren't what matter. The quality of arguments is what matters.
Okay.
The right thing to do is what they're the best arguments for doing, not what the most people vote for. I think there's an assumption behind Steve's original question that I want to challenge, though. It's easy to overestimate the amount of disagreement there is among philosophers on moral issues. You call in a philosopher, in George's phrase, only because you're concerned about the hardest and most difficult and most complicated issues there are. Now, there are lots of simple and easy issues that everybody agrees on. We don't want to talk about those because they're not so interesting. They're not the ones that trouble us. Philosophers disagree about abortion. All right? If you were to go to the philosophical community and ask, what have you decided about abortion? You'd hear 1,000 voices saying 1,000 different things. You might conclude, well, there's no truth here. There is simply the mass of conflicting opinion. There's no help to be had. But, of course, you've asked about the hardest and most difficult and most complicated question you could possibly ask about. If you went to physicists and asked about the hardest, most difficult, and most complicated question in physics, you might also hear 1,000 voices saying 1,000 different things. If you asked about some simple matter, you would find substantial agreement. And I think in philosophy, if you ask about simple matters, you might find substantial agreement too.
I think that's right, but people don't call in philosophers about simple matters.
I suppose the point I wanted to make is that the reason there is so much disagreement amongst philosophers is not because you're dealing in an area where there's no truth. It's because we're only interested in the hardest and most difficult questions. But if all you're interested in is help, and you're not just looking for definitive answers, then I think that even philosophers who disagree a lot about what the definitive answer is could agree about the sort of help that you ought to be given. What philosophers can do mm-hmm. is to show you ways of looking at issues that you hadn't thought of before, to point out assumptions that you may have been making that you didn't even recognize that you'd been making, alternatives that may not have occurred to you may have maybe pointed out distinctions that you haven't thought of, arguments that you haven't taken mm-hmm. into consideration, objections to your own arguments that you hadn't thought about. And all of this is help to you in thinking about mm-hmm. a practical issue.
It at least deepens your thought, whether it helps get you to a solution or not, if done well, if done by a thoughtful philosopher. I take it from any of a number of conceivable positions, it deepens your thought. Is there a sort of, let me just say one more thing and then please jump in. Is there a sort of hope that you get, that you discern, Steve, from these people in the medical schools or other places, that they're calling the philosopher in part because they want to make sure they haven't missed anything important? That is, not so much that they're going to solve the problem, but is there something staring us in the face here that we've missed?
I think the experience with medical ethics is a very interesting one, because physicians individually and medical institutions overall have been remarkably open. The medical profession, I think, deserves credit for its willingness to talk with philosophers and raise these issues. I have often wondered why it is that the medical profession is open to philosophers. Business people have been rather willing to talk with philosophers. Philosophers have indeed looked at virtually all professions except one. The one profession philosophers never seem to look at is the academic profession, their own profession. There's medical ethics, business ethics, engineering ethics, but there's no academic ethics. And what would happen if a philosopher were to walk into a colleague and say, I'm doing an examination of the ethics of college teachers, and what I would like to do is to attend your classes, sit in on your office hours, look at your examination practices, and then do a moral critique of what you are doing.
That's a little close to home, isn't it?
I think that we would very quickly hear cries of academic freedom being infringed. And I for one, am sorry that philosophers have not reflected on their own profession, because I think that many of the issues that are raised in more exotic locales, such as the hospital, can be found equally within what is, for the philosopher, the less exotic locale of the classroom.
Why do you suspect this is the case, that philosophers haven't, or ethicists haven't, don't do as much work in their own backyard as they do in visiting other areas? Is it a prejudice, or is there reason to think that...
The reason that medical ethics has grown in such a huge field over the past few years is very simply that there have been a lot of jobs available in medical ethics. Jobs teaching philosophy in colleges started to become very hard to get about 10 years ago. Something happened in the employment market for college teachers. Nowadays, a young person who's looking out for his future is not well advised to go to graduate school in philosophy because there aren't that many jobs as college teachers available. All right. At about the same time that jobs teaching philosophy in traditional colleges became scarce, jobs began to open up in the medical centers because, as Steve Kahn said a moment ago, doctors' hospitals have been remarkably open. There have not been the same number of jobs that have come available for philosophers in engineering schools or business schools. Therefore, engineering ethics and business ethics is not as big a field as medical ethics. There are no jobs available in the field of academic ethics.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been an excerpt from a discussion of philosophy and public policy. The speakers were Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center, George Schur, a scholar at the center and professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont, and James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy, the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to listen this week for Soundings. This week's program looks at art and ideas in 20th century American and English drama. In a second segment, Soundings will examine professional ethics and education in a discussion of the contributions and limitations of philosophy as it bears on questions of public policy. I hope you'll join me this week for Soundings.